Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We're about to have conversations over the course of the next 2 hours that really are on many people's minds about what's going on in our world today. In this first hour, we're going to talk about not just Robert Vales, the U.S. Army Staff Sergeant who allegedly killed 16 civilians in two Afghan villages, almost 43 years to the day after the My Lai massacre in Vietnam, as I was talking about with Woody Curry, one of our guests this evening. But all of that means, and all that's tied into this, is much more complex than just this. It has to do with sending people back not ready for combat, the tours of duty that people are taking in this war. It has to do with what war does. It has to do with a quote that I'll read at the top of the hour. It has to do with a lot of things. We're going to come back to that. In the next hour, we're going to look at the murder that took place in Florida and talk about what is going on with African-American young men, the police, and murders in this country. All that's coming up. So right now, we're turning this over to WEAA Traffic to check on the roads, and we'll be right back. So please, stay with us. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. I want to remind you before we jump into our conversations today that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, this is a credit union, not just a bank, so it belongs to you. www.mecu.com. You can go to steinershow.org and click on their banner there. And we were looking at other programs we were going to do. A quote popped up that I really, really kind of hit me. I don't know how many of you saw the movie The Battle of Algiers, which is probably one of the best movies ever made, at least from my perspective. It was made about the Algerian War with the French for their independence and the vagaries and pain and terror of war on all sides when you fight a war. And there was a quote in there from the French colonel of the paratroopers who was going after the Algerians, who was conducting the torture, doing many other things. But he made this quote to the press in the movie, which I thought fits almost any war you can think about. He said, "Should we stay in Algeria? If your answer is yes, then you must accept the consequences." And that can go for any war, I think, that you fight. Doesn't mean that things go blameless. Just means if it's a nation that decides to do something, you better accept the consequences of a war. We are going to wrestle with all that and what happened with Robert Vales, what war does to men and women who fight it, what war does to men and women who suffer through it because they are people in the country the war is being fought within. We are joined by four men this afternoon, three of whom are veterans. Woody Curry, who's in my studio here now with me, is an old friend and colleague who helped us make our documentary project on the Vietnam War back in 2005, and is clinical associate director of the Baltimore Station that is a center that works with mostly veterans who are dealing with drug, alcohol, and other issues that they face. And Woody, good to have you back in the studio. Welcome.
Thanks, Mark. Glad to be back.
Joshua Kors is with us, investigative reporter for The Nation magazine, has been doing a lot of work over these last several years in talking about the men who are not getting their benefits, talking about what happens to the men and women who come back and being returned to combat and not being given their proper diagnosis when they come back. And Joshua, good to have you with us once again. Welcome.
Good to be with you, Mark.
Chuck Luther is with us. He's a former Army sergeant, founder and executive director of Disposable Warrior Soldiers Advocacy Group, received a personality disorder charge from the Army. And Chuck, welcome. Good to have you back with us as well.
Thanks, Mark. Good to be here.
And Graham Klumpner is with us. He was an Army Ranger in Afghanistan, 2005-2006, and one of the organizers of Iraq Veterans Against the War. And Graham, good to have you back with us as well.
Thank you for having me.
Number is 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888, to join in on this conversation. So here we have Robert Vales is now in custody, I think, in Fort Leavenworth. Most people know what they think are the details of what they know about the incident, but they're more complex than what we think, probably. A man who was on his fourth tour, first time in Afghanistan, fourth tour of duty, had his foot, part of his foot blown off, had a brain injury, was suffering post-traumatic stress, was sent back deemed fit to fight combat, even though this is the first tour he didn't want to go back, but was sent back. The other three tours he was ready to go and gung-ho about it. And this incident took place. And it's also interesting to me, is we and I were talking, this takes place almost to the day, 43 years after the My Lai incident in the war of Woody's and my generation. So let's kind of wrestle with what we think, what all your reactions to this is, just in a broad sense, and we'll go into details with you all later. And let me start with you, Graham Kluppner, and then we'll go down the line to Chuck, Josh, and then Woody.
Thank you. Well, I think that, you know, this is it's a tragic incident. It's a shocking and tragic incident. But for those of us who have served overseas, I think that the understanding of the amount of anxiety and stress that you're under in those types of environments leads us to not be so surprised that an incident like this could happen. This man had a traumatic brain injury, which I myself experienced in Afghanistan as well. And there's the net that is there to catch traumatic brain injuries and catch a lot of like post-traumatic stress, it's very weak. And even with the changes that have happened in the last couple of years, hundreds of thousands of soldiers, according to the Department of Defense, are suffering from post-traumatic stress and have experienced traumatic brain injuries or military sexual assault. So we've got an epidemic in the military, and this is what this is the manifestation. This is the end result of a whole process of not taking care of our soldiers along the way.
Let me turn to Chuck Luther. Chuck.
I have to fully agree with that. I believe that we do a very, very, very poor job on taking care of our soldiers downrange. When they do step up and say there's an issue or they're having some problems, we're ridiculed, stigmatized, and then thrown to the wayside. And I just want to point out one small thing here about the post that this soldier came from also. It doesn't have the best history for taking care of soldiers, because we just remember a couple years back we had the episodes that soldiers went on trial for murder and doing some things they shouldn't do in there. And also just within the last month or so, the Madigan Army Hospital up there at Fort Lewis, Washington, with the scandal of the forensic team of PTSD guys that were changing diagnosis to save the Army money. So it is a very, very weak system. The higher-ups in the Department of Army in Washington, D.C., they get it. I think they have a full grasp of what it has to do and what we need to do for our folks. But the problem is there's a disconnect all the way down to the level where the soldiers actually serve and need that support. It's just not there.
Josh Kors. Josh McCors.
I think that's absolutely it. Lack of support, a weak net, really hits at the heart of this issue. So many steps down the line of these soldiers' deployments, there's self-evaluation. Soldiers are meant to step forward if they think they're suffering from PTSD. And there's really not an incentive for soldiers to do that. They want to stay with their unit. Upon leaving, they want to get right back to their families. I think that this tragedy really should spark two discussions. First, that there's a need for more rigorous evaluation, much further than self-evaluation. And second, whether we should really have soldiers who are going on fourth, fifth, and sixth deployments at all. Perhaps a new regulation could come where they cap deployments at three, and after that, soldiers would phase into a different aspect of the Army.
Woody Curry.
Yeah, I heard it all before. That's when I thought about My Lai. I was thinking about the guy, Sergeant Bales. I feel for the guy. I mean, you know, I know that's not a popular, but, you know, I'm being objective. And I'm being, I feel for the guy. It's a war. And stuff like that happens, all right? And every now and then we get a snapshot, and somebody's out front on it, right? And then, but like Vietnam, that happens. And then you come back to the States, and they wonder what's wrong with you, you know? They laid those labels on us, baby killers, all that kind of stuff, right? So I had some personal feelings. That's why I told you I've been dealing with this for a while when you mentioned it. But I'm talking to this recon Marine buddy of mine, and he and I was sitting there talking, and it was like, we always going to have wars, but we need to, we have this need to make it presentable or rational so that everybody can somehow be all right with the explanations that we give and stuff. You know, it's like four deployments and but, you know, it would have been kind of hard in my unit for somebody to just get away from everybody like that and go off by himself. And, you know, I can't pass judgment right now on any of that stuff. You know, I'm not sure we're hearing everything anyway.
We may not be hearing everything. I wonder what let me ask before you this question. I mean, where is the line that one draws when it comes to war and what happens inside war with the behavior of individuals inside of war?
It's almost like the Rubicon. You know that? What Caesar did with the Rubicon?
Yeah. He's
looking for the line. It's almost like that. It's on paper, and it's conceptually there. It's hard, Mark, for me to explain this to people who haven't.
Yeah, I understand that, but you know,
I'm not justifying anything. Right. Okay, in the context of civilized discussion,
right?
But that's not what we're talking about.
I mean, you can jump into this. I really want to hear your thoughts on this. I'm going to throw this up. What I was saying to Woody, I was thinking about conversations I had with another friend of ours who is a Marine veteran from the same war, Vietnam War. And talking about the lines that do get drawn. He was a good friend of Hugh Thompson's, who was a helicopter pilot who stopped the My Lai massacre when it was going on, training his guns on his some of his own friends and people in soldiers in the U.S. Army, and he stopped it. So the question is, where's the line? How do you draw that line? And what happens to where we in the civilian world have to look at this? And Woody just laid some stuff down. I'm going to come back to Woody, but Graham, let me go to you first.
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. But part of this whole discussion that we're having, and I think the previous gentleman just really touched on it, was that in war there really aren't these lines. Like, at times you can follow them, but a lot of the regulations and rules are very difficult to implement in a rapidly changing, dangerous, violent situation. And part of getting a soldier ready for that environment is what the U.S. military does to you throughout training and then once you get your unit. And that's a process of dehumanization, because it begins with the individual. You come in as an American individual. You know, we're all individuals in this country. We love talking about that. And once you step into the military, you lose your individuality. They cut your hair. They put you in the same uniform. They give you a number. They regiment your entire life, tell you when to do things and when not to do things. So once you go through that process and get to your unit, the dehumanization continues as it extends to the enemy or the other. In this case, it's the people of Afghanistan or the Taliban, Al-Qaeda. But it's really, within the military, it's a very broad conception of the other being the people who are not in my unit or the people who are not in my military. And that includes civilians sometimes. And when we send people overseas and we turn them on to killing, we take so-called normalized people in our society and train them to kill, that dehumanization process is very difficult to turn off. And, you know, you can say platitudes about helping the people and winning the hearts and minds, but when you're in an environment where you're very likely to be shot at and possibly wounded or killed, or you see your friends hurt next to you or killed next to you, the human reactions, the possibly natural human reactions that happen can be shocking, but I think they are a part of war, which begs the question, if this is a product of modern war, do we understand that as a culture, as the American people, do we understand what it means when we go to war? And I don't think we do, because if we understood what kind of trauma happens on both sides, no one's talking about the Afghan people that were massacred. No one's talking about their families and how they feel right now. This trauma happens on both sides. It's the only difference is the Americans get to come home and sometimes go to a VA hospital. The people of Afghanistan or Iraq or wherever, they don't have any hospitals to go to get post-traumatic stress treatment.
You said a lot, and I want to kind of, and please, Josh, I can't see Josh or Chuck, so if I can hear you getting me break in, you can come jump in. I mean, I'd like to hear your thoughts about where these lines are.
Well, I would say that
Joshua Kors.
Yeah, I would say that, you know, a lot of us have our hearts and minds with these families who've been victimized in this awful scenario. I think many Americans feel for them, you know, as victims of a terrible crime. The reason our focus is on America and on these soldiers is because we have an opportunity here to change the way the Army functions and to make a difference so that this doesn't happen again. You know, I was talking the other day with Captain Paul Buca, who is a Medal of Honor winner, and he said the biggest change we could make from here forward is eliminating the D in PTSD. Now, Mark, you and I have spoken before about what a terrible term that is anyway, PTSD.
Right.
Drained of life, used to be called shell shock, something much more understandable. If they took the D away, took away the disorder, a lot more soldiers would be encouraged to go in and seek help if it was just post-traumatic stress. And maybe one of those soldiers would have been, you know, Sergeant Robert Bales, or many of the others who are holding back some of the things they're struggling with. I think the incentive here is with the soldiers, and the onus is on the families, too, if they see problems, to step forward and seek help before erratic and dangerous behavior happens.
What do you, go ahead. Chuck, then I was about to say something, too, but go ahead, Chuck.
Okay. Hey, I was just digesting all this. I have to say exactly what Graham said was, you know, as a former soldier, a reconnaissance scout that lived out in theater and on the wire and saw these folks, I've stayed in touch with a couple of members of Iraqi families that we actually lived amongst and watched some of their children killed in crossfire. And, you know, I have to say, first and foremost, we have to fully understand the what war is. You see, we paint a pretty picture in the media, and when we try to get the American public behind us to go into these wars, we give them this picture, and we sell it to them. We're great salesmen in this country, and we go off and we go into war, and people don't understand exactly what it is over there. You know, I was called weak. I was called less of a man because I was not okay with watching innocent people killed. Unfortunately, I was involved in firefights. Gentlemen that would want to arm a weapon and point it at me and kill members of my unit, I knew what had to be done to stop that threat. But it didn't make it any easier to say, well, he had a gun so I can exterminate his life and walk over his body and be okay at the end of the day. I wasn't okay, and if I'm less of a man for that, then I guess that's what it is, but I don't believe so. I think that I have a respect for humanism and for life. And at the end of the day, we push our soldiers. I mean, we push them so hard, and I know we're soldiers, and I know we're a volunteer force, and I'll tell you what, I respect the utmost of every Vietnam vet out there because they didn't have a choice to go. They didn't sign up and say, let me do it for the most part. They made them go, and then they brought them home and treated them just as they did. And the reason why I'm here today still to talk and fight is I refuse to allow my generation of veterans to have to go through what they did. And also, we need to be the role models to help our Vietnam veteran counterparts to heal from what they weren't allowed to heal from. And back to the subject is that, you know, guys are pushed and pulled and prodded, and they're put out there over and over. And when they stand up and say, I don't want to go, it's not that we're not patriotic. It's not that we're not men. It's that we can't do this any longer. But then we're told you're either going to go or you're going to get a bad conduct discharge and you will have nothing in life, which what we know now may not be so bad as the aspect of the American public thinking that we're all psychopaths now because we have this disorder, as Josh just highlighted, that it's not a disorder, it's an injury. I wasn't born with post-traumatic stress. I just actually got injured in the battle. And it comes down to the bottom line. When we get to the point of realization of the cost of war, maybe then and only then will our politicians quit using us as pawns and putting us out into a battlefield. And then whenever we do something that's out of the ordinary or inhumane, we don't know what to do. The crazy thing is, I watched a lot of reports in Iraq in 06 or 08 during the surge at the Diyala province. I watched a ton of reports come down the wire and called collateral damage. So why can't our government just step in and tell President Karzai, hey, guy, I'm sorry. You know what? That's collateral damage. That's the cost of war.
Well, and Chuck, I think this is a good time to insert here that, you know, 2.4 million Americans have served in Iraq and Afghanistan. Over 100,000 of those have been deployed three or more times. And the overwhelming majority have performed with honor and with dignity. This is a very rare instance of one soldier who stepped off the rails.
What are you about to say something?
No, no, really. I've heard all of this numerous times. Really. It's nothing being said now that I haven't heard before. It's the same procedure. It's the same thing. I mean, after My Lai, after Vietnam, everybody was saying the same things. We need to take a look at what we do. We need these guys. We pushed them too far. They went over the edge. They turned into drug addicts. They did this, they did that. So, you know, we need to civilize warfare so it'll be more palatable to whoever finds out what goes on after the fact and then start saying why it should have been like locking the barn door after the horse runned off. You know, it's not a cut and dried answer. I tell you what, it's a cut and dried answer. It's about killing people. That's what the military, that's what combat's about. You know,
well,
and you do it within certain guidelines. You try to the best you can, you know, and it puts a lot of stress on you to do that. And then afterwards, your normal shame and guilt responses kick in, and you really have a very hard time being all right with yourself, you know, and then nobody else is all right with you either. You know, it's kind of a real tough situation to be in as a veteran,
I
you know.
Well, let me finish, then jump right in.
You know what I'm saying? So I hope this guy, I hope everybody gets their, whatever it is they're trying to get resolved. And I hope this guy gets some help with what he needs. And as far, you know, the dehumanization part, I was in kind of a different situation, Mark, and you have some personal knowledge of this. I hung around the Vietnamese people as an American soldier. I was assigned along with them. You saw how I got along with them when we were there, right?
Well, you were a translator.
Yeah, and so they were the enemy, but I knew them too. And then I'm an American soldier in a war that nobody even knows anything about, right? So then things happen in a war. You kill people. They weren't dehumanized. I knew them. I talked to him every day. I understood him. So, you know, it's like a whole different kind of ball game. It's kind of complex. It is not as simple, cut and dried answers as people think it is.
So well, who's this trying to break in? Was that Josh or was that Chuck Graham?
Yeah, that was me. I want to say that this future here does not have to be like the aftermath of Vietnam. There are millions of families in this country that want to be there for the soldiers, that want to be there to support the military families. And the question is, how can they do that? What can they do to make this different?
Well, actually, this is Graham. I'd like to say that part of the thing for me when I got out of the military, I struggled heavily with alcohol abuse. And I left in 2007, and I had had a traumatic brain injury. I was dealing with traumatic stress, and you know, I didn't really have a lot of outlets, and I was actually recalled to active duty. I was finally enrolled in college. I was pulled back into active duty, and they were trying to send me to Iraq for a year and a half to do convoy operations. And this is after being a ranger. I didn't really want to go sit on, be a security person on a truck and get blown up. That wasn't really in my interest. And so I reached out, and one of the groups that actually helped me was Iraq Veterans Against the War, which I later joined and now work with, and we've got a program called Operation Recovery, and it's the first time that we've got an organizing model to really help change the system within the military. We take a lot of lessons from movements of the past, including the civil rights movement, but primarily we're targeting the three major traumas, which are post-traumatic stress, traumatic brain injuries, and military sexual trauma, which is the military's euphemism for rape and sexual assault. And we involve all citizens, not just veterans, not just soldiers, but to help hold the military accountable to its regulations it already has. Like, they have rules that state that soldiers shouldn't be deployed when they have received a TBI or they have been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress. And commanders at military bases around the country have the ability to overrule a doctor's medical orders, and that is wrong. And we are trying to change that. We're trying to stop the deployment of traumatized soldiers. So you can go to IVAW.org and get more information about it. But that is one way that we are reaching out to the community and getting a connection between the civilians and the soldiers of our country.
So should we take this break now? You want to take a break in 2 minutes? 2 minutes? All right, we'll take a break. So I think that one of the things that come out of this, the conversation so far, and the number here, by the way, is 410-319-8888. And we'll go to a call before we go to break. There's no way to pretty up war. When it's unleashed, it's unleashed. So I think that, I mean, we have to think about what a lot of things mean that people have raised here in the first half an hour of this program that we're going to come back to after a brief break. But before we get there, a lot of people are calling in. We like all the veterans who listen to the show. You join us here at 410-319-8888. Actually, it looks like we only have a minute to break. So let's just go to break early, get this done. Then we'll go to Refran and all the people calling in. We'll get to their calls when we come back. When we come back from break, there'll be a very brief news report from some breaking news from our WEA news department, and come back to our discussion with Woody Curry, Joshua Kors, Chuck Cluther, and Graham Klumpner. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We are here with Woody Curry, Clinical Associate Executive Director of the Baltimore Station, Joshua Kors, Investigative Reporter for The Nation magazine, Chuck Cluther, former Army Sergeant, founder and executive director of the Disposable Warriors Soldiers Advocacy Group, received a personality disorder discharge from the Army, veteran of Iraq. Graham Klumpner, Army Ranger in Afghanistan, 2005-2006, organizer of Iraq Veterans Against the War. And we are talking about what happened with Robert Bales, but even more than that, what is going on with our troops, what is happening with the traumatic brain injuries, with post-traumatic stress, people being sent back to war, and what happened with Robert Bales. I'm going to come to in a minute what Woody was saying in the studio with me before we went, while we're doing break, which I think is important to raise. Let's go to the phones first at 410-319-8888. And Fran in Greenbelt, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark. Hello, everybody.
Welcome.
I just want to tell you, first of all, my heart goes out to all you guys. I'm a bit of a warrior myself in my own way. And I want to encourage you to stick together and make changes for you and your friends and for future veterans that will be fighting in wars, because it's very important. I'll tell you one story very briefly. My own brother-in-law was a Marine. He has since lived a full life and died, but he was 18 when he went over to Vietnam. He served two terms. The day they got off the plane, the first term that he was there, they told them to go onto maneuvers and shoot anything that moved in the bushes. Well, something moved, and it was a 12-year-old girl, and he killed her. This is an 18-year-old guy now, and he did that. And that haunted him. He went through two terms.
Tours,
thank you. Second tour, he had a grenade thrown at him, and it didn't explode. And he told my sister, he says, if they send me back a third time, I'm not coming back. And he suffered with all of that. Later in years, he ended up molesting his daughter around the same age that it was of the girl that he killed. And we feel that he did that because of that experience. It deeply disturbed him so much that these demons and all these things came out, because during that time, they didn't have even some of the things that they have in place now to deal with PTSD and all of those things. And they ended up getting divorced, not necessarily because of that, but they mm-hmm. ended up getting divorced. And his life really went downhill from there on. And so it doesn't have to be that way for you guys. It doesn't. This is your time, and this is you. You take care of you. If your country says, okay, you did your tour for us, then, you know, go and live your life, and they're not doing what you think that they should, you do for you.
Okay.
Okay? You take care of you, because you're what matters, and you're going to have to deal with what happened there and here everybody comes back conflicted, and you're going to have to sort it out.
Find
people who love you and that will give you what you need.
Fran, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate you calling in. And so I want, just picking up on that before we go back to the phones. We have to come back to Robert Bales, this war, and what we expect, and what should we expect right now? I mean, we're not talking about whether we should end the war. That'll be tomorrow's show. We're going to talk about the end, whether or not we should be in or out of Afghanistan at this moment, and how do we get out of Afghanistan? When the majority of people of Afghanistan want you out, majority of Americans want us out, but we're still there. But what happens now? Robert Bales, many things could have happened. We were talking during the break. I said to Woody, what kind of prosecution should there be? What do we think this says? What are the things we need to wrestle with here as American society when it comes to this war, the men and women are fighting it, and this case with Robert Bales, who went over there, had a traumatic brain injury. That morning, saw one of his buddies next to him get his leg blown off, drank, went out and did whatever he did, came back and turned himself in. Now, and I just want to know what we think needs to happen at this point, and what America needs to wrestle with, and what the service has to do at this point, and then come back to some other stuff, Woody, and then we'll go to back to Graham and Joshua and Chuck.
No, as a clinician, you know, I'm in that bag, you know, with a traumatic brain injury and then drinking on top of it, you know, that's who knows what the effects of the alcohol is. It affects the brain anyway, the judgment. It's the first thing it affects. And then with a TBI, there's no question as to what's going on. Then you put the anxiety and the deteriorating situation he's finding at home and all of that stuff piling up on one, and you drink to get away from it. You know, a person in an alcoholic blackout goes into a bout almost like the brain's not recording anything that's going on. They can go through the motions of doing something that they are automatically used to doing. Like, you know, you can go out and do things. You can do whatever you would do if you weren't under the influence. You couldn't even tell a person was in a blackout. The thing is that you don't remember any of it after it's over. You come out of it and don't remember any of it. That's just a consideration. Being a clinician, I got to look at everything. And looking at all of those different variables. I'm just talking about this one guy. You know, there's no talent, Mark. You know, I find it kind of difficult to find out how a guy can get off base by himself, not be missed by anybody, go somewhere and shoot up two houses full of people and then set them on fire and then come back and turn himself in before anybody goes to find out what's happening. I mean, that's a lot of noise. Where was everybody? If this is just one guy, where were the rest of the people?
Those are all good questions.
You see what I'm saying? It's not that clear to me how one person can just... I'm not trying to defend anything. I'm just being open and looking at all the possibilities of what's going on. You know, I don't want to get all caught up in that because, you know, but I do have certain biases, I guess, a soldier. I just, you know.
As someone wrote in, you said a soldier. Someone wrote in to the New York Times today, maybe one of the things a soldier wrote in, say maybe they should stop calling us warriors and start calling us soldiers again, and maybe we would be more disciplined about what happens. Graham?
Well, I don't know about that, but I think it's important to, you know, recognize that the military and the government have been referring to this situation as like a bad apple, and we don't have all the facts, and we don't know, for example, if there was one or many multiple soldiers. We don't know how this thing went down. So the first priority, I think, is from the military's investigation standpoint, is they need to make this as transparent as possible, because we don't have a very good history of transparency when we try people. And when we look at, the history, going all the way back to My Lai and before, like, we've had numerous times where soldiers were on trial and they were protected by their own. We had the seven soldiers that, we had the kill team, which was a conviction, but we had the seven soldiers who were involved in the Iraqi Marine massacre. I mean, like, soldiers and Marines get off a lot of the times in these situations. I don't think that'll happen in this situation, and my heart goes out to them, too. I know exactly, you know, I've walked the same boot steps that he walked over there. I've been on the same Ford operating bases. I know I can visualize like that night and that and that experience. That doesn't mean that it's justified at all. He needs to be held accountable. But we need to look at this in a larger context. And in some ways, Staff Sergeant Bales represents the United States. You know, every soldier over there is an ambassador of our nation to others, for good or for ill. And in this case, it's ill, and it's there's been numerous incidents like this. I served with soldiers, and I serve with veterans now who have numerous stories about boundary crossing and line crossing, whether it's, you know, not clearing your fields of fire or shooting at someone who you haven't actually verified had a weapon. Or, you know, there's a whole spectrum of really disgusting things that may just be a product of modern war. And again, we have to ask ourselves, is this worth it? Are we safer now than we were on September 10th, 2011, or 2001, excuse me?
No, right. And let me take up from there what you were just saying, Graham, and ask for you this question, then we'll go back to the phones. And Jay from Middle River is the next caller up. Is that, in terms of what you were just saying, I mean, people can look at this as a indictment of the war in Afghanistan right now. Is it that? Or is it an indictment, as Joshua Kors has been covering for a while now, the way men and women who fought in these two wars have been misdiagnosed, not allowed to have the diagnosis they need, sent back into combat when they should have been sent back into combat, like given the benefits they needed when they were hurt in war arguments over what brain trauma is and what behavior is, what personality disorder is. Is that the problem? Is the problem that it's war, period, and that when you have a professional army, you're going to have a smaller army, and people are going to be redeployed over and over again because the nature of a smaller army, as opposed to Vietnam, where you volunteered for a second tour if you wanted it, but most people who drafted or volunteered went for one tour and came home.
Well, one thing is for sure, the trial of Sergeant Bales is going to play out over the next few years, and I hope in that time it comes out the details of exactly how in-depth was he screened. Was he, you know, screened again before this most recent deployment? You know, there is a sense that a lot of these soldiers, they're not getting the thorough evaluation at each of the stages, and they need that if we're going to be assured that these soldiers are healthy after each of these deployments.
And it does raise that issue. So, I mean, and I think that why this conversation is not about whether we should be in Afghanistan or not in this conversation, but what we're doing to the men and women who are there fighting and what has happened to them and what's happened to the Afghan people. As you said earlier, Graham, no one's talking about the family who moved next to a military base or near a military base, the father said, to get away from the Taliban, only to be slaughtered by American soldiers. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I was actually just going to say that, you know, we're talking about deployed soldiers and multiply deployed soldiers, and we always try to look for that to be a justification as if, you know, okay, well, more deployments make somebody, you know, more liable to snap. But when we look at the total suicide population within the military, the majority of people, soldiers who have killed themselves, have not deployed. So this is a question about the entire military culture. It's not just about one deployment or one certain base that he went to or one night that he had too much alcohol. This is a systemic problem that is from the beginning to the end. I mean, one in three women in the military are sexually assaulted in their careers. One out of every three women. That is an institutionalized problem that is not being addressed.
And, of course, we've talked before about how 18 soldiers are killing themselves every day. And that's a death rate here in the United States that's far greater than the death rate in Iraq and Afghanistan.
18 soldiers a day. Let me go back to the phones. Chuck, did you want to add anything before we hit the phones again?
Yeah, let me just step up and first say, first and foremost, from my last comment, I do not support and I'm not justifying anything that allegedly Staff Sergeant Bales has done. I don't condone murder of innocent people, especially women and children. But the questions that I would have, the same questions. One, you just don't walk off of a combat outpost or a forward operating base. You just don't do it. that, you know, some of the things that are coming out saying it was an Afghan soldier that identified, saw him leave, and alerted some people. And by the time they corralled a search party, he had already returned back, and they found out what he did. And I'm sorry, to walk in two houses, one person with one weapon, with no protective gear, to fire them up and then set people on fire and then walk casually back a mile to the base, it just doesn't add up. And I hope the transparency, Graham hit on the head, we have got to have transparency on this, because it just can get hit up. And, you know, the other thing about it is a culture change that has to happen. We are not going to stop having wars. The day that our president declared a war on terrorism, he wrote a check that I don't know if we can ever cash. It's going to be an ongoing task. And so we need to get past the point of no more war, because that's not going to happen in 2012 and beyond. So what we can do is come to the point of understanding of what is too much for a soldier, what are the indicators and the risk mitigators to look at, is somebody more of a risk than another to commit something like this. And then when it happens, don't throw your hands up and start a smear campaign for your own soldier by saying he was convicted of assault in 2000 or 2002, but not give the details. It could have been an argument in a parking lot, and a police officer heard him and arrested somebody, and he had financial troubles. And you start smear campaigning out there before this guy's ever been corralled up and questioned, and they start doing an investigation. So it has to be a culture change, and we have to practice what we preach. We have great programs in the United States military to take care of people. We have some of the best technology and the best doctors and psychologists out there to understand what is going on with our folks because of all the past wars. So it's the problem about putting it into practice, bottom line.
Let's go to the phones at 410-319-8888. Jay in Middle River, you're on the air.
Hey, good evening, gentlemen, and thanks so much for your service. We appreciate it. It's a two-part question I have. One, and I think Mark hit on this earlier, what is the reasonable expectation of wartime, results for soldiers? I mean, because you can't get any closer to help in war. I mean, so what is the reasonable expectation about dealing with it? And on the topic of dealing with it, if you say that there's a culture change required for the military, is that going to come from within, from the soldiers? Because we know that that is not the most effective thought process to have, because the organization itself doesn't really cater to or welcome a groundswell from a grassroots perspective. Is it going to be military families? Because so often they're left in the dark about what happens with soldiers dealing with PTS and other wartime issues. So, it just seems like a losing proposition on both ends of when you join and who can actually do something about it. And thanks for taking my call.
I think this is a really interesting question about the idea of changing military culture, and what does that mean, really?
Yeah, and I would change it to what?
Well, answer that question. We'll go around the room and see what other people think. What do you mean, change it to what?
That's what I want to know. What are you going to change?
Well, I can answer that. I'm dealing with a case right now at one of our largest deployed bases in the United States, in the U.S. Army, and I'm taking on a case of two E-7s, actually an E-7, a sergeant first class, and a sergeant first class promotable who's fixing to make master sergeant. They were both relieved for duty and for calls because of their scuffing up one of their soldiers who fell asleep during a memorial ceremony on post. So they took him into a room, and they said, "What is wrong with you, soldier?" He said, "I'm tired because we've been out training for the last 36 hours, and they brought us in to sit through a memorial of somebody we didn't even know." He fell asleep. So they, in turn, decided to call him, allegedly, derogatory names. They talked about his parents. They talked about his girlfriend. They made him do push-ups until he actually used the restroom on himself. Then they told him to go change, take a shower, come back within 30 minutes, and then they continued to exercise him for another 4.5 hours until he vomited and became dehydrated and was taken to the medical aid station for treatment. And now we have these two E-7s that were relieved from command, but they were just reinstalled because they said that they were good soldiers. One just came off recruiter duty, did two tours in Afghanistan, was a former drill sergeant. The other one just got home from Iraq in September, and this happened in November of last year. And they said, you know what, these guys' careers are spectacular, and we're not going to relieve them for that. They're heading towards retirement. The soldier just needs to man up, and the soldier needs to be a soldier or go home. That's the culture change that has to change. We are soldiers. I'm a professional soldier. I'm a reconnaissance scout by trade. My job is a very particular job, and I do it just like Graham's job as a ranger, particular job. When he said that he didn't want to go sit on a convoy and get blown up, that is professionalism that he was trained to do. So, but what it does say is that you don't tell a person because you fell asleep, you're less of a man, and we have the right to physically abuse you and mentally abuse you to the point of, let's just put a side note on it, that this soldier has tried to commit suicide twice now, and he's being chaperoned out of the Army for misconduct.
So can you change military culture?
Yes, you can.
You remember Sergeant McEwen?
I'm not sure.
My uncle was in 1st Marine Division in Korea. I come from a military family, I guess. That's why I was in. But anyway, in Paris Island, South Carolina, Marine Drill Sergeant marched some recruits down in the
school. Oh, yes, right.
Remember that? That was 50 years ago.
Right.
Right? That happened. And it was the big investigation and the Marine Corps drill instructor training, and then they revised the way that people were treated in boot camp as a result of that systematically across the board. But, you know, I'm just being a realist, Mark. What we need to do is constantly try to make things, I don't know what, easier is not a military. You're going to have snapshots and things like this are going to happen, and they'll be addressed, and hopefully some kind of changes may come about as a result of it, right? But I'm looking at a historical picture that it seems like every now and then something comes up that sort of spotlights something that somebody did that we need to take a look at. You know, it's grist for the mill.
So, and Josh, you know. I'm sorry, Josh, from somebody before, a few minutes we have left, from somebody who is reporting this, investigative reporter, looking from the outside in many ways, what is your sense of what it means to change military culture? What does that mean?
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, I think the broader question is, what's it going to take to change American culture where these soldiers aren't just dropped back into our society and left to fend for themselves? I think if many Americans knew the struggles of these soldiers and reached out to them, then they wouldn't have this extraordinary suicide rate. You know, Mark, just looking at the statistics, they really are amazing. In 2010, before these two wars, the suicide rate of recruits into the Army were half of the general public because they were being screened and what have you. After these two wars, that rate has doubled. And the question is, you know, more than just, you know, the strain of the two wars, what is our country not doing to be there for these soldiers?
Graham, I mean, I'm curious what you think it means to if it's impossible, what it means to change military, or even as Joshua said, American culture. What does it mean to change military culture?
Well, I think, first of all, it's very easy to, say that these things are historical, or these things have always happened, wars always happen, so it always will. I think I refuse to accept that. I wouldn't be sitting here still alive today if I believed that were true. So I think it starts on an individual basis, but we have to protect people. And these are systemic problems within the military culture. It's not just one thing every 20, 30 years popping up. A lot of it doesn't get reported. I mean, hazing in the Rangers is institutionalized. I've been thrown down concrete steps in a sleeping bag, tied up in a chair, left in the shower for hours on my birthday. I mean, these things are a daily occurrence, and they're considered to be necessary in order to get soldiers ready to go to war. So we as veterans and soldiers have to communicate the reality with the help of the media and others to the general population. And just that understanding of what the reality is of serving in the U.S. military today in the modern world, once we communicate that reality, it'll go a long way to being able to have discussions about, is this something we really want? Because, you know, like some of the panelists have said, if the American people truly understood war and understood what it meant, what it was like to serve in the military and what happened in the military, I think the American people would be shocked and would have to have a long time to rearrange their thoughts on modern war.
We had this conversation, Mark, with this Vietnamese general outside of Hanoi. What was the guy's name? We were sitting up on this porch. He had his little hut down where he went to do his writing.
Right.
But he was the general, I think, was in charge of anti-aircraft sites around Hanoi, right?
I remember that.
And we went and visited his house, and we were sitting up on the porch having this conversation with a Vietnamese general, you, him, and I, and Wayne.
And Wayne, I remember
And we
all
were
that.
Talking back and forth about atrocities and how things went down and all of that stuff, openly sharing this stuff from opposite sides.
Right,
and we
that.
Were basically coming to the same kind of conclusions, right? But we also came to the conclusion that it's going to keep on going down, too, didn't we?
I remember all that. I remember that conversation.
You remember the conversation? Yes, so this was in a broader context than what we're sitting here just talking about our side of the war and what we think. But, I mean, when you sit down with the opposite side, you remember the conversations we had with the Vietnamese soldier when we were sitting in the hotel room. He and I were talking, and we had the conversation. I asked him what outfit he was in, and we looked at each other and started laughing. Say, you know, we was probably shooting at each other down in the Central Highlands, the guy Bao Ninh.
Right. Oh, yeah, Bao Ninh, the guy, the author.
Who wrote
the writer.
The book.
Right.
I'm older and wiser now. You know, a lot older than most of the guys that we're even sitting here talking to. I've been through, like, 3 wars, and I'm still in it because I'm now treating guys from Afghanistan and Iraq and having gone through that whole process myself after Vietnam. So I got a very personal, intimate knowledge. I never got out of it, really. You know, it's the same stuff over and over and over again. One thing I think that people don't see about war, and when you dehumanize the other person, you lose your humanity at the same time. So it's not a win-win situation either way it goes down. I mean, you lose your humanity by dehumanizing somebody else. So life doesn't become yours or anybody else's.
So,
you know?
I mean, I think that at the conclusion, because we'll have like a minute left or less, is that in this conversation, is what we need to pick up maybe together again, is really what it means, if it is even possible to change military culture, what that means.
Mm-hmm.
What it means for a society that has only a professional army and not a nation where everybody serves, if it serves, which makes a huge difference.
Mark, in the remaining seconds, I just want to say that if any military families are listening, there is help out there. Tonight on joshuacoors.com, my website, I'll be posting a comprehensive list of resources that any family who is in need can go to and get the help.
Joshua Coors, investigative reporter, Nation Magazine, Woody Curry, clinical associate director of Baltimore Station, veteran of the Vietnam War, Chuck Luther, former Army sergeant, founder and executive director of Disposable Workers Soldiers Advocacy Group, served in Iraq, Graham Klumpner, Army Ranger in Afghanistan, organizer with the Iraq Veterans Against the War. Gentlemen, thank you all so much for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to have you all, brothers, with us. And we'll take a brief break and come back and switch gears in this conversation, looking at the tragic death that took place in Florida and what is happening to young African-American men in this society with police and others. Stay with us. We'll be right back.